talk something about history, may I ask you for a piece of paper, because I want to draw a little diagram and show it to you, what perhaps the most important change today is in science. Conception of history. You see, what we have in public domination, general opinion, are all conceptions of history starting from an origin up to the present. A one-line history. Take a typical example in the 19th century, the Kantian conception of history. There's first a theological phase, then you get a metaphysical phase, then you get a phase of positive science. Now if you arrange them in a line, you get something like that, a line, and like that, and then you get phases on it, one following the other, and when the next comes, the older one has to come up. So now that no longer works empirically. You would have to make, if you want to make similar diagrams, something like that, you see, this would be the coordinate, and then you get, say, from beginning, anywhere that you want to start, with a paleolithic or something like that, a beginning. And from that you get then branches off what I call the differentiation. One element after another becomes clear until you reach clearness about types of consciousness in Greek or in Egyptian and on. And you can then these branchings off represent like that. And when you then push through a cross cut at any present point P, you get always a cross cut through everything, including the things which, according to the conventional conceptions, are obsolete. To give you an example, for instance, we're talking about the Neolithic method, there is a very good study by Mircea Eliade on the fortune of the crucible, where he traces the concern, the myth of man being able to transform reality back to the metallurgical beginnings in the Neolithic age. Because metallurgy was interpreted as the extraction of a pure metal from an ore, not as a pure metal extracted from an ore, but an impure substance transformed into a pure substance. So this transformation into the pure substance, that was mystified in various myths. And this metallurgical myth is a constant going through the history of mankind right to the present, where you ultimately want to transform, say, for instance, the nature of man in various revolutionary conceptions like the Marxian or the Hegelian or the Kantian and so on. So that is a neolithic metallurgical myth that one can transform the nature of man. And such a neolithic element, for instance, is to be found in one of the most decisive elements in what you call modern. So the modern is not the right point, but the characteristically dominant feature today in modern is a neolithic metallurgical myth. So let me give that as an example. Yeah.
Would you say that there's always some kind of set of structures that are dominant, or do you use that as part of your hypothesis in this kind of a structure?
Which structures are the dominant at any given time? That is a purely empirical question. I found it all out also, but without knowing that it's a metallurgical myth. But you find these structures, that's why I'm so much interested in Paul now, in the various apocalyptic, Gnostic, alchemistic, and Neoplatonic conceptions. So this all, say, from approximately the apocalyptic beginning of the second century before Christ, the Book of Daniel is about 165. From there on, you get then transformations of this metallurgical myth in the environment of the Neolithic, which we call the apocalypse, and they are the ones in that literary form which are today the dominant ones. And they have been all the way through in continuity in that long range of sectarian movements accompanying the main churches, and breaking them to the public level with the Reformation. What you might call underground sectarian movements, which contain these elements, you see, are in continuity present. Gibbon saw that already, the chapter of this matter in Gibbon, and responsible now has given the continuity of the archive materials that we have of it. And but it was an underground or fringe movement until the breakthrough came with the Reformation. It became an upper movement, institutionalized, in competition with the Church and Empire and all. And in that form we have it still today. And probably it is on its way out today, because it is completely known, this derivation, one also knows it is anti-common sense and anti-reason. And when such things are discovered and ever more people know about it, you see, then such a movement is on its way out. We shouldn't mean that it will not be dominant for the next 100 years, but it's finished as far as the level of science and philosophy is concerned. Nobody can today responsibly be any more than ideologist. It's impossible, because we know what it means. Your question was, which are these structures? There you get such a dominant structure, say, from roughly 1500 to the year 2000, probably. Perhaps still going on for a while. And then, what then will come to the fore, we don't know. We have certain indications, you see, because when the great conflict between these various sectarian movements come, the first in the 16th century, usually I call them the world of religion, have little to do with religion, I call them the dogmatomachies, you see, the various types of wars between the dogmas. Then you get, say, one figure in it, like Baudin, who knows that the solution has to be, it was his suggestion, a king of France cannot belong to the Catholic or the Protestant Church, he must be a mystic. That is the only way of being beyond the fighting parties which had the eight civil wars in France in the 16th century. And there's the same problem in the 20th century, when you get this dogmatomachy coming underway, as they well did in the 1920s, there's one philosopher, Henri Bergson, who, for instance, in his De Surtout le Moral et de la Religion, has the same position as Baudin. You have to be a mystic in order to get out of that mess. So, the solution probably will be, solution in the sense what will come, there will be a new wave of mysticism instead of the dogmatomachy. So I will leave it under your question, what is just dominant and so on. And such dominant types last for a considerable time. They have empirical knowledge about it, insofar as usually periods of such a kind last empirically 250 years. Then come changes. So if you count, say, 1500, the beginning of the Reformation, around that time, 250 years will bring you to the middle of the 18th century with a great incision in the middle, with the outbreak now of the Enlightenment type, yeah, which has absorbed a considerable portion of Neoplatonism. And if you add 250 years to come to the end of the 20th century, do you have some hope that the mess will be over by that time, empirically? But there's no rule or I cannot explain it, only if you look at periods, they run around 250 years. So that would be, for instance, a change in the conception of history. That nothing is obsolete, nothing is old, but precisely the older stuff are the ones which are supposedly modern. Explains why, because you mentioned that we do not have antiquities and oddities in antiquity, but they are interesting because they will be found presently in our public opinion. So a good deal of what today we call the public opinion, you might say, the revolutionary students who want to have freedom now and all that stuff, you see, that is typical methodology of senioritic age. In the metallurgical myth of the Neolithic age, in the transformations that you get through apocalypse and gnosis and so on. So that is what we have today as a revolting student, as the most modern and newest stuff.
Wouldn't you say that it's only really taking a hold now, like China, Roland becoming obsolete?
Yes.
And Africa and so on, so that it might have a very long reign.
new year, when things become institutionalized, of course, that introduces a new factor. When you take the case of Marxism, Marxism was as dead as a doornail before the First World War. And has then got a sudden new life because of the romanticism of power in Russia. Because there was a communist revolution in Russia. And then all of a sudden, from the institutional side, it's the impression such a power success had, Marxism became fashionable again. It's still, as far as theory is concerned, is dead as a doornail. But you get all these people who now, in their sectarian fanaticism, enjoy it tremendously. So they also must complain at the same time that they are in conflict with reality. In Eastern Europe itself, in Poland, in Russia, and so, everybody is a commonplace now. Communism as an ideology is useless because it doesn't explain the meaning of personal existence and cannot cope with the problem of death. Everybody knows that. So you can't give lectures on communism today in Moscow. You will be laughed out of court. Only in the West we still have that romanticism.